Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Is building a prison the way out of the financial hole for struggling rural counties? Ray Geringer raises the question and gets answers in this latest in our series, State of Justice.
Gregory Hooks is a professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. He and his colleagues have conducted two comprehensive studies into the impacts of new prison construction on rural county economics across the United States.
We collected data on each county in the United States over approximately a 35-year period, looking at the employment trends and a number of the other social and demographic characteristics of the counties. And we also collected data on all of the prisons in the United States, those prisons that were already in place at the beginning of our study period, that'd be 1969, and those prisons that were built in the intervening years. And our goal was to see whether those counties that had a prison in place already or were selected for a new prison in the period that we studied actually benefited from it. Overarching findings was that we found that a prison present in a county had very little impact whatsoever, positive or negative. And then we pursued that question in greater detail, looking at the counties that were supposed to be benefited the most. We really focused our attention on those counties that were lagging in terms of employment growth before the prison came. And what we found is that we did find a statistically significant impact, but that impact was negative. The counties that in which a new prison was built, we found actually had slower employment growth, not faster. So we concluded that to the extent that prisons are doing anything in rural counties in the United States, they were doing more harm than good on the employment front.
Eastern Kentucky is no stranger to this push to build new prisons and to frame existing prisons as providers of much-needed jobs in the face of the coal industry's decline. Judah Shept is an associate professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University, where he teaches and writes about the carceral state.
The United States has the largest system of incarceration in the world. We incarcerate 2.3 million people. That accounts for just over 20% of the global population of people who are incarcerated. We incarcerate about 700 per 100,000 people in our population, which is also really disproportionate to the rest of the world. Jail and prison growth in rural communities has been a particular strategy of rural economic development for close to 40 years. Starting in the 1980s, you see the United States starting to build increasing numbers of prisons in rural counties every year. So that at this point, the last statistic that I saw was that 350 new prisons had been built in rural areas of the United States since the early 1980s. That's a national rural phenomenon, right? We could be talking about this in upstate New York or the Central Valley of California or rural southern Georgia, West Texas, Mississippi Delta, areas of Colorado, and of course here in central Appalachia, where there are 16 prisons. Half of those are in eastern Kentucky, and most of those 16 have been built during this period that I was just describing, and most of them built really since 1990. And almost all of those through appeals to the sort of economic development promises or economic development sort of opportunities that they would generate and provide, despite, I have to add, seriously dubious evidence of that strategy. It's particularly important to think about this in the context of the state of Kentucky for a couple of reasons. One is, like every other state, Kentucky's incarcerated population grew exponentially over the last 40 years, but particularly so over the last 20. Partly because of that, the state prison system is really grotesquely overcrowded. The Kentucky Department of Corrections has about 24,000 people under its jurisdiction. And so that's 24,000 people that you would expect would be incarcerated in a state prison. But because it's so overcrowded, half the people that are under the jurisdiction of the State Department of Corrections are in fact incarcerated in county jails, many of which are rural county jails. Why is that important? Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. I mean, county jails are not designed to hold people to be incarcerated for longer than a year. And so even as state prisons have lost a lot of the programs geared towards rehabilitation and education and things like that, that we traditionally have invested in, county jails have far fewer. Another reason why that's particularly important is that rural counties around the state have recognized that what we call sort of carceral expansion, essentially just building out jail or prison capacity, is a way to generate revenue because the state pays a per diem rate for every person that they incarcerate in a given county. So it actually costs the state less to incarcerate someone at the county level. So it saves the state money while it also provides often struggling rural counties with some much needed revenue. And that happens around the state of Kentucky. But to me, it takes on particular salience in eastern Kentucky in the coal fields because of the loss of the coal severance tax, which of course was this once reliable source of millions and millions of dollars of revenue for coal producing counties. But as coal production has declined, counties have seen the receipts from this once reliable source of revenue dramatically decline. And so counties have in part turned to building out county jails, or in fact building new county jails, in part as a strategy to be able to recoup some of that revenue loss from the loss of the coal severance tax. And so in that way, the jail is really not just about, you know, what we think it is, like crime and punishment. It's really kind of built into these much larger economic and political problems and issues that counties face, particularly rural counties in struggling regions.
Dan Mosley is the county judge executive for Harlan County, Kentucky, and he's seen the effects of the drastic decrease of coal severance tax funding firsthand. Mosley says that in 2012, Harlan County received about $8.5 million from coal severance taxes. That was a particularly high year, but he says that in an average year, the county would receive between $4 and $5 million. Mosley says that during his 6 years in office, the amount of coal severance funds the county receives has declined every year. Last year, he tells me, Harlan County received only about $1.5 million in coal severance taxes. Mosley says the loss of those coal severance funds has impacted all parts of the county's budget, including funding for the county jail.
Jail funding is paid for by taxpayers all across this country. And it is funneled through either local county tax dollars that are paid for through property tax here in some counties, occupational tax, or other, you know, insurance taxes, that form of taxes. At the state level in Kentucky, the state pays for state prisoners that are held in the jail. For instance, the Harlan County Jail has a 235-bed capacity, and which generally pre-COVID would have numbers about 150 state inmates and about 70 or 80 county inmates. The state pays a daily per diem that is equivalent to about $30 and some change per day per inmate. The cost of housing those inmates or higher than that. The state established a per diem to pay counties for housing of state inmates back in the mid-1980s was the last time that per diem was raised. So counties essentially have been receiving the same amounts of funding from the state for the last 30 years, despite increased costs. You know, especially at a time, particularly in eastern and western Kentucky, when we've seen the decline in coal severance tax funding that has, you know, helped fund quality of life issues for our people for years, such as water projects and sewer projects and parks and recreation and those types of things that fire departments, those funding mechanisms have dried up because the downturn in the coal industry. So, you know, counties have less funding already. But then the fact that the cost to incarcerate continues to go up, you know, it's really breaking counties. No jail makes money. You might have some private prisons that can break even or maybe a little bit ahead, but there's no county jail in Kentucky that is profitable. We are in Harlan County, I think 1 year we ended up about $230,000 in the red on hours. But generally, it's about anywhere from $500,000 to $800,000 a year that we lose on our jail. And I'm aware of some counties that lose $1.2 to $1.5 million a year on their jail. But at the end of the day, here's the problem. 95% of our inmates, and this varies too across the state, but it's generally north of 90%, are incarcerated people due to the drug problem that exists all across the country. And if taxpayers are very, there's a lot of people that have a lot of skepticism about drug treatment programs. But if the taxpayers truly understood how much of their tax dollars was going to fund jails and incarcerate people, they would be a lot bigger fans of drug treatment programs. We're always going to need jails. There's always going to be bad people that break the law that need to be incarcerated for some reason. But some of these people that are truly addicted that need the mental health aspect side of this and the rehabilitation aspect, they're not getting that rehab in jail. They get it at treatment centers. And you know, hopefully with this criminal justice reform we've seen at the federal level, and some of that has trickled down obviously already to the states, we will see more opportunity to shift from incarcerating drug offenders, particularly those that are just addicted, not traffickers. And I don't have a high tolerance for drug traffickers, but these people that are making bad decisions because they got on a medicine because they had a health issue, or you know, they got hurt in the mines and have got addicted to painkillers. Those people need substantive rehabilitation, and we need to be figuring out a way to invest more resources into those programs and help also create a mindset with our people that educates the public on, if we spent less money on jails, let's say we could make our jail break even. All right. Well, that means that we would spend $500,000 less a year on jail. Well, $500,000 a year we could spend on rehabilitating water systems to avoid having busted water lines in a community that has 40-year-old infrastructure. Or we could spend $500,000 in investing in running a sewer project to a community that might serve 150 to 200 households. We could build a couple of additional parks to serve our kids, to give our kids a place to get out and play and our families a chance to recreate. Those types of investments could be made annually if we could figure out how to reduce our costs of operating. Yeah, like I said, we're fortunate here. Like I said, I'm just thankful that I'm not having to raise taxes to pay for the cost of operating the jail at this point.
Criminal justice reform advocates across the country say that strategies for reducing jail budgets include investing in community-based substance use disorder treatment centers, strengthening reentry programs to reduce recidivism, and reducing the number of people who end up in the jail in the first place through bail reform and changes to pretrial detention. For WEKU, I'm Ray Geringer.
State of Justice, a series exploring issues related to the criminal justice system in Eastern Kentucky, is provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. One of the nation's 126 federal and military prisons sits about a 15-minute drive from Inez in Martin County. Roughly 1,260 people are housed there. Most will eventually be released back into society, and the quality of their contact with the outside world while incarcerated will often determine whether they will become productive and law-abiding or commit crimes again and return to prison. Many prisoners request contact with somebody from the outside to help them survive incarceration, live constructive lives, and try to maintain self-esteem. And one of those people from the outside world who responds to that need joins us now from Prestonsburg. Jean Rosenberg, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much.
And if you would first tell us about the Prisoner Visitation and Support Program.
Well, we try to visit prisoners who have requested visits, and they do that through their case managers. They don't ordinarily receive visits from family and friends. They may be serving long sentences or even on death row, not here in Big Sandy, but that all those things are part of the focus of providing prisoners with regular face-to-face contact with someone.
And when did you begin doing this? When did you begin volunteering to visit prisoners?
In 2015. And I did it in the most unusual way. My ophthalmologist, who was visiting at Big Sandy, said, "Gene, I think you'd make a great prison visitor," and gave me the contact information, but I wasn't ready and I didn't follow up. And eventually I did. He'd moved away. But I've been doing it ever since.
Well, these are people who've been convicted of committing crimes serious enough for them to end up in a federal prison. Why do you do this?
Well, number one, you know what I tell prisoners when they ask me that question? They say, "Why are you here?" And I say, "Listen, if I were in prison, I would want somebody to visit me." That's pretty simple and nuts and bolts. But the truth of the matter is, I feel like we are all part of a community, and how we treat each other makes a difference. And that's one of the reasons that I started, but I carried on because I've had such an incredibly enriching experience. I probably have visited 30 different fellows over the last 6 years, and each one of them has a story, and I've learned a lot.
Well, tell us about that very first visit. What was it like for you? And did you go in with any preconceived notions about the people you would be meeting that maybe were dispelled after you did meet them?
Well, I was pretty scared, but I had another woman had been recruited through her church to go. So the two of us went through the process of gaining entry together. So it wasn't like I was totally alone, but it is intimidating to hear the noises and see the doors shut and open and wait and then being allowed to cross the certain areas. It's a very regimented with an eye on security for everybody. And so when I got to the visiting room, it was like a big open room with plastic chairs. And you sat in one, and the prisoner you were coming to see sat in the other. And you were three linoleum squares away from each other. And I was really worried. And the thing that I was worried about was, what does a middle-class retiree who doesn't follow sports, what will I have to say?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is that prisoner visitation support emphasizes that you're there to listen, and you're there to provide the kind of interaction that helps people cope with whatever's on their mind. And I really leave it up to the prisoner to set the agenda for the conversation.
And I take it that right now, because of the pandemic, these visitations are on hold?
They are, but the organization itself is so well respected in the Bureau of Prisons, they have allowed prisoners to receive correspondence from the PVS volunteer. We generally do not have any contact other than that face-to-face visit and a very short note telling the prison when we expect to visit. And it's a different level of communication when you're corresponding with somebody. And it's incredibly interesting.
I'm sure it is. And as I understand it, you've been willing to visit with anybody who's guilty of any offense. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. The emphasis of prisoner visitation and support is that you're not there as the counselor or judge or lawyer or anything, but you're there to respond to a human being. And sometimes the fellows go into great detail about what got them where they are. Mm-hmm. And other times it's not mentioned, and I don't bring it up unless they mention it. I let them lead.
Have you visited with prisoners in solitary?
Yes, I visit fellows who are in the special housing, and that is done in a different fashion. I'm taken to a small room with a telephone, and then there's the glass between us, and we communicate over the telephone.
Do you notice generally a difference in the demeanor of those who are in solitary versus those who are in the general prison population?
You know, it just depends. That brings to mind one of the fellows I visited who had been recruited by one of the people in his cell area, and he had applied to PVS, and here I was sitting in a chair across from him, and he was so nervous, he was ready to jump out of his skin because I was his first visitor in 21 years.
Oh, wow.
One of the advantages of getting a visitor at Big Sandy is that you get pulled away from the general population into the visiting area. And, of course, the visiting area is inhabited by families mostly, and there are kids, and there are lots of noise and confusion. And if you're used to a more organized and regimented situation, that can be pretty overwhelming. And he told me that he hadn't slept in 2 days being worried about coming to the visiting room and what he would do if there was people were running around him, because many people in jail become very hypervigilant to movement, and he was certainly one of them. And we've laughed over that. I've been visiting now for 3 years, we can always laugh when we remember how it was in that early visit. We visit once a month, and visitors are asked to make a 2-year commitment so that there is a consistency when they start.
Well, I'm imagining that first as you drive away from the prison, and then when you're back home and a day or so has gone by and you're processing what you've been through, that you've taken away something. What have you gained from this experience?
Oh, I have grown as a human being because I've never had any contact with prison. I've never been in a confinement. I think all of us know, having been through this COVID experience and had avenues of movement cut off, that we have a reaction to that. And I know now at a much deeper level what the fellows are going through that I visit. And One of the things I was so conscious of and continue to be is how many freedoms I have and how many choices I make, where to invest my time, what to do. All those things are under my control. Whereas when you're in prison, it is, you don't know who the cellie is that's going to be put with you. Everything from their eating habits to everything is you have to adjust to, and you don't have any choices.
Is there a constant search for additional volunteers like you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I have been so inspired by some of the fellows that I have met. Oh, that's another thing, that talk about preconceptions. I thought that when I visited with somebody, that they would be developmentally delayed in some way, academically, not very articulate. And that is so far from the truth. My experience is the folks who want a visitor and apply for one are usually in the category of gifted intellectually. And studies have shown that in the general population, you know, it's 3 to 5% of the populations are gifted people. In prison, it's like 20. And of course, they self-select. So I have often found myself really stretched theologically, politically, you name it, to respond.
Well, how can someone who's listening to us and has become interested in looking into this, how can they find out more?
Well, I would think the best way is to go online to prisonervisitation.org. They have a website, and, you know, they guide you through the process of applying, and you get a bigger picture of the whole operation. There are more than 400 volunteer visitors like myself across the country. We in Eastern Kentucky have a little bit more of a challenge in getting volunteers, and that's why I'm so grateful that I'm having this chance to talk about prisoner visitation to you.
That's Jean Rosenberg of Prestonsburg. She's a volunteer in the Prisoner Visitation and Support Program. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you, Tom.
In 2019, a multi-state, multi-million dollar study was launched with the goal of reducing overdose deaths around the Ohio Valley. Then the coronavirus arrived and overdose fatalities surged. But addiction researchers are renewing their efforts. In the final of a series of reports, Corinne Boyer looks at how the pandemic has changed addiction treatment.
Since last summer, the Madison County Health Department in Kentucky has provided the overdose reversal drug Narcan and training to anyone interested in learning how to use it. Two health workers operate a van that serves Richmond. Laura Nagel is a risk reduction specialist with the health department and says the University of Kentucky has helped with its outreach.
The mobile unit is a part of Madison County's harm reduction team, but UK provides the Narcan. So we actually couldn't do this outreach if it weren't for the Healing Communities Project.
The Healing Communities research involves communities in Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York. With $350 million behind it, it's the country's largest examination of substance abuse. The COVID-19 pandemic has complicated that work and other efforts to treat opioid use disorder and reduce overdose deaths. But the pandemic has also prompted new approaches to tackle the addiction crisis. Here's an example. When someone decides to get medication to assist their treatment for opioid addiction, the first step usually involves a visit to a doctor's office. That in-person evaluation is required to receive medication like buprenorphine, used to treat opioid use disorder. Addiction medicine doctor Kelly Clark says that process has changed during the pandemic.
So now, if you're looking for treatment, which the core piece of opioid addiction treatment is medicine, you can call, do audio visual, and start medication with buprenorphine using telemedicine.
Sharon Walsh is a professor of behavioral science and the principal investigator of the Healing Community Study at UK. The study's goal is to reduce opioid overdose deaths by 40%. Walsh says the pandemic prompted the release of naloxone much sooner than planned.
Trying to make sure we could get naloxone into people's hands who were leaving jails, who were coming to syringe service programs, who were coming to treatment programs so that they would have that life-saving medication.
The study brought the university the largest grant in its history, $87 million. Addiction treatments vary between communities participating in the study. Walsh says the funding allows researchers to look at what communities have and what they need.
We're deploying some staff from our partner agencies into some of our community agencies. We are installing kiosks in pharmacies for drug disposal. We have counties that don't have any drug disposal units.
The Ohio State University received nearly $66 million to lead Ohio's Healing Community Study. Dr. Rebecca Jackson, the study's principal investigator, says the study also looks at rural and urban communities to see what strategies are the most effective in different settings.
How do we really promote health equity for all? How do we make sure that as we institute interventions, ways to reduce disease, that we bring everybody along and that we don't have things that might work for the majority, but might put some groups at even a greater differential?
Things like naloxone, telemedicine, and drug disposal boxes aren't new ideas. What is new is the increased scale of efforts and the careful focus on what really works at the local level. Data from these combinations of practices will ultimately show healing community study researchers what's successful. That will allow communities to design programs tailored for them. At a time when the country, and especially the Ohio Valley, are suffering from record numbers of overdose deaths, those treatment options will be crucial throughout the pandemic. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Corinne Boyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Coming up after the break, a change of subject.
I think that one thing I've learned working with people who've known their share of hard times is that a sense of humor is very much a survival mechanism.
Harlan novelist Robert Guype and...
There's something that's very fulfilling and gratifying and soul-stirring about getting into the soil.
Black Soil's Ashley Smith. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts. On March 2nd, get ready for the Poetry Out Loud State Championship, sponsored by the Kentucky Arts Council, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Poetry Foundation. This poetry recitation contest is for Kentucky high school students and will be held virtually via Facebook Live. The state champion will advance to national finals later this year. For information on how to view the live stream, visit the Arts Council's Facebook page, keywords Kentucky Arts Council. And the Kentucky Artisan Center at Berea continues its sixth annual Reveal exhibit in the center's lobby. The exhibit features work by 11 Kentucky artists and runs through April 30th. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Robert Guype won the 2015 Weatherford Award for Outstanding Appalachian Novel for his first novel, Trampoline. His second, Weed Eater, was published in 2018. And now comes Pop, the third in this trilogy, all of them published by Ohio University Press. Says Publishers Weekly, a headlong tumble into a proud and problem-plagued Appalachia, this addictive illustrated novel by Guype is a delightful gab fest. Comedy and tragedy make way for unexpected uplift in this richly detailed story of people determined not to be forgotten. And I'll add that the whole thing is delightfully illustrated in Robert's own unique style. He's a Kingsport native, now living in Harlan. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
So back in 2017, writing about your first Trampoline for Cold Mountain Review, Zachary Vernon said, "Rare is the novel that delivers on all that's promised by fans or by the carefully curated blurbs featured on its cover, but in my mind, Trampoline fulfills these promises, portraying Appalachia in a manner that falls prey neither to the demeaning stereotypes nor the romanticized clichés that are commonly associated with the region and its literature." For anybody who's just finding out about you and your writing, Robert, tell us about that portrayal of our region.
Well, I mean, I just have lived and worked in Eastern Kentucky since 1989, 31 years, I guess. And I've generally been doing community-based work since then. Worked at Apple Shop for 6 years, and have worked at Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College since 1997. Just writing about a life based on the life I've lived, and you know, went to done a lot of writing workshops where they teach you how to just look at what you see and listen to what you hear, and try to make fiction out of it that people recognize as real. And so, you know, that ends up being complicated. It ends up being all the colors and the emotional palette and all the rest of it. So at least we've got Zach Vernon fooled, don't we, Tom?
Well, if you would set the scene for us, especially for anybody who hasn't read your trilogy yet, but maybe they will now, set the scene for us, you know, the when and where of the stories told in Trampoline, Weed Eater, and now Pop.
Trampoline is set around 1997-98 in a coal field county. It's not one that actually exists. It's called Kennard County. And it deals with communities or families fight really to protect a mountain from strip mining, using the land zone suitable for mining, federal definition of lands that should be exempted from strip mining. The second book, Weed Eater, takes place mostly in 2004. It's kind of set at what for me and or what I felt, you know, at the time and still pretty much do, was kind of the nadir of the opioid crisis in my community. And then the third book, Pop, it's set in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election and takes place mostly in 2016. And then the last section takes place on Old Christmas, January 6, 2017.
What really catch my eye and my mind, Robert, are phrases like, she walked through the smoke like she was the fire. And Eastern Kentucky had been snowed under all January, but that day the sun was out bright as prison lights. Where do these phrases come from?
I always try and think of metaphor as a way to reveal character, because I write in the first person. And so, you know, you're always trying to think of... for this character, what would be, you know, what would be that bright in their experience? And then also, you know, just trying to be cool, trying to make it memorable.
Well, you've said that the sound of people telling one another stories is the most precious sound in the world. Trying to catch that sound on the page is your favorite part of writing. How do you do that? How do you capture dialect in a way that rings true, but it's not caricature?
Yeah. I think the thing is like, I've been involved with documentary work a lot. I worked at a documentary film production center in Whitesburg, Apple Shop. And then a lot of the work I do at school is oral history based. And so dealing with language as it is a good experience for writing effective dialogue. I really don't think too much about dialect. I mean, one of the things I've said it before, but it's worth saying again, I think a lot of what reveals the way people talk isn't so much focusing on the pronunciation as it is on syntax, where they put sentences together, the way that, what words they choose. I think the other thing is that every character, one of the parts of building that character is like just thinking about how fast they talk. I mean, I think all of us have patterns in how long our sentences are, how short our sentences are, and just building that into who is this person, but not so worried about necessarily an accent or this, you know, how it sounds actually.
Well, this being radio, we can't show your illustrations to our listeners, of course, but I would say that your drawings tell stories all by themselves. Do you recall when you first started drawing these characters?
I mostly, started drawing to stay out of trouble in school as a way of channeling all of my unwanted remarks into the mouths of other people that I would draw in my notebooks and stuff. And then that's been a fairly effective technique for not sticking my foot in my mouth more than I do in a variety of institutional and bureaucratic settings since then. And I definitely think that my characters have evolved out of that kind of safety valve of creating little people in your notebooks to say the things you don't want to get caught saying.
Noted. Maybe we all ought to take that advice.
Well, it's only reduced the trouble I've gotten into by a percentage. It hasn't kept me clear out of trouble, but it's reduced the number of episodes anyway.
Your fellow Kentucky novelist, Carter Sickles, mentions in a review that you are, quote, funny but not cynical and compassionate without falling into sentimentality. So I'm just wondering, do you have to really work at that balance, or does it just kind of come naturally?
I think that might be an older quote. I'm not sure that the cynicism hasn't capsized my sympathy boat, but I think that one thing I've learned of working with people who've known their share of hard times is that a sense of humor is very much a survival mechanism and a way to maintain hope and not get too lost in despair. But I also think, you know, that looking at things funny is a way of, and most comedians have their share of anger, you know, and they're expressing that kind of dissatisfaction with things as they are through that kind of comic outlook.
Well, by the time that this is on the air, your latest pop should be hitting store shelves and online availability.
Also, I've been ordering a lot of books lately through bookshop.org, which supports local and independent booksellers.
Bookshop.org. You'll find Robert Guype's works there, Trampoline, Weed Eater, and now Pop. And we thank you for joining us, Robert.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
In last week's edition, AppHarvest founder Jonathan Webb talked about partnering with Black Soil, a group formed to support African-American farmers in Kentucky. Well, it's Chris Begley's focus in this latest in his Future Tense series.
Today on Future Tense, I'm excited to have Ashley Smith. She's a co-founder of Black Soil, Our Better Nature, an organization to reconnect Black Kentuckians to their legacy and heritage in agriculture. Welcome, Ashley. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chris. Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, as an archaeologist, we study the origins of agriculture in many contexts, and we recognize that this is just incredibly important in our human history. It really was a turning point. You know, if you identify three or four big ones in the history of humanity, that's definitely one. And I wanted to know, for you, why is it so important?
Well, first and foremost, when we think about agriculture, we think about the necessities in our life, our food, clothing, shelter, the fiber, things used to provide us with the things necessary to live, breathe, and enjoy our existence. So beyond eating, it provides us with the essential protection from the elements of clothing, a place to live and stay. And it also works very diligently as I approach the work as a sociologist. It exposes the glaring underbellies and undertones of our society, the imbalances and the inequities and disparities, as well as the opportunities to have those foundational needs met through agriculture as an industry and a sector.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about where you see these inequities connecting with agriculture?
Yes. So I know we'll talk more about, obviously, COVID-19 and the global pandemic and what it's really exposed even further. But here in the state of Kentucky, looking at food insecurity, children under the age of 18 living in poverty, nearly 50%, right now at 45%, and how for the work as an industry outsider coming into agriculture, very wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, seeing oftentimes accessing food through institutions and organizations are much more complex and complicated than they need to be. And so by working to simplify and making something that's so practical and necessary, yet again, those foundational needs for life and sustaining oneself, it works to showcase how we're in need of not only each other in helping educate and provide outreach to communities to help them understand where their food comes from, connect them with their grower and that farm family and its story. And so the approach that Black Soil takes with agriculture is one of looking at this necessary field and trying to apply it to the practicality of everyday, to the everyday person, because everyone has to eat.
Now, during the pandemic, a lot of things have been revealed, like you said, the underbelly of our system, the ugly inequities and things of that nature. I wanted to ask what you think the pandemic has revealed to you about our relationship with agriculture.
Well, to continue in that vein, families such as yours, you know, you all were early adapters to the work of Black Soil, coming on a farm tour in 2017. We were like really, you know, dipping our toe and putting our arm into cracking a door. And so now as we fast forward to a moment in our society, in our country, our globe, where folks are really wanting to be reconnected in this time of social isolation, stay-at-home orders, civil unrest, protests, upheavals of systems, and people are looking for deeper meaning and purpose, and there's something that's very fulfilling, gratifying, and soul-stirring about getting into the soil. Having a garden that's empowering, you have been able to direct your time, energy, and productivity towards growing something that will directly benefit your family. So I think there's a reward, a gratification in our instant gratification society that it provides. I feel also the rush towards farmers markets and CSA enrollments and sign-ups. That was our COVID-19 pivot with the work of Black Soil. So rather than having in-person events, we saw the demand to have households be connected directly to small-scale, home-based, sometimes classified as socially disadvantaged, marginalized producers. But these individuals, again, have been coming to Lexington and the surrounding areas since 2017. So being ready for those consumers who were hungry, no pun intended, for local options, either be seasonal produce, local meats, goods, and wares.
Well, thanks very much, Ashley, for talking with us. Ashley Smith, co-founder of Black Soil.
Thanks, Chris. Have a great one.
They say they go in threes, and in fairly quick succession, we recently lost a triad of legendary Kentucky musicians. This began on the 10th of February with the passing of Lee Sexton, the Letcher County born and raised drop thumb banjo player, whose music is known across the country. Here he is in an interview with WYMT, recalling first learning to play the banjo more than 80 years ago.
Well, I was 7 years old, and I went school with a boy named Creel Lutz, and he had a banjo he wanted to sell me. I was raised awful hard, you know. I tried to borrow a dollar off my grandpa to get that banjo. He had about 3 acres of corn field, he said if you'll cut all of them corn stalks, burn them, pile them up and burn them, said I'll give you a dollar. Well, it took me nearly a month to, you know, to get clean that up. He gave me a dollar and I run every step down Lime Fork, this boy's home, and I bought it. And I can't read music, not a line of it. But I can hear a tune from here in New York. And if I like the tune, I can play it.
Lee Sexton went on to become the master artist in residence at the Hindman Settlement School, the subject of the documentary Lime Fork, and recipient of the Kentucky Governor's Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts. February 17th brought news that we had lost Michael Stamper from Hazel Green, educated at Hindman Settlement School, better known as Nick Stump, co-founding singer and guitarist with the Metropolitan Blues All-Stars. An obituary in the Herald Leader, penned in a style Nick surely would approve, notes, Nick Stump was a poet, a pundit, a screenwriter, a veteran, an outlaw, a storyteller, a scoundrel, a rook champion, a yellow dog Democrat, an autodidact, a proud son of the bluegrass, and a citizen of the Big Blue Nation. He loved America, ale-ate, bourbon, and singing his stories to anyone that needed to hear them. And then on February 19th, we learned that Ashland-born jazz singer Gail Winters had passed.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love.
Gail lost her career opening for the likes of Joe Cocker and Roy Orbison and went on to record in New York for RCA and play clubs like The Village Gate and Blue Note. She performed the second hour on Red Barn Radio in 2018. And you can listen to that program this Saturday at 7 and Sunday at 8 here on WEKU. Information on ways to listen at weku.org. And our condolences to the families of Nick Stump, Lee Sexton, and Gail Winters.
Oh, you guys are great. Thank you so much.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org. on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.